I hereby introduce to you, Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, 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 welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. Welcome to this episode. Today, we are bringing this episode is brought to you by Amazing FBA and the private label course that we've just created, which is so new, I haven't even officially named it yet. You can help in that process. We are making 10 places available for beta testers only, and we have already probably got about 6 or 7 of those taken by last count. So there are only about 3 places left. So the full price of the course is going to be £395 from September. The beta testers are going to get it at half price, so just £195 or dollar equivalent, whatever that is, about $270, something like that. Why should you consider this? Well, it's step by step for people who are absolutely starting out from scratch. We have about 6 hours of content recorded so far, and we'll probably end up with about 10, but we've broken it into tiny absorbable chunks of 2 to 3, 4 minutes per video in most cases. It's step by step. Not only that, but you're going to start off by learning the basics of Amazon with a bit of quick and dirty retail arbitrage. That's how we work. You don't have to do that, but it's a very, very wise starting point. Then the second thing we offer is how to test products that are not private labeled, but are as close to that as you can get to test out the market, learn your skills, learn to import and export, get comfortable with the process, and then move on to private labeling. So it's all about learning, doing, and reviewing. That whole circle, virtuous circle, is the entire philosophy of the course. And I believe that that gives it a bit of a unique spin, although a lot of the stuff, the mechanics will be similar to what's out there, but the way we put it together as a structure, as a course, I think is reflective of how the podcast works. It's just to be dynamic, to be real, to be focused, and to actually focus on real results, not less fantasy and more doing and more action and results. So if that interests you, just send me an email, michael@amazingfba.com, M-I-C-H-A-E-L for Michael, michael@amazingfba.com. And in the subject line, simply say that you're interested in the private label course beta. That's it. Thanks so much for listening. Now on with the show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. Today, I'm delighted to welcome to the show John Kant of Rising Sun Commerce. And that is a very, very important person for us to talk to, because not only is John a British Amazon seller himself, so he gets the nuances that go with that, but also he has a very big background in Japanese culture, married to a Japanese lady, I understand, and lived there for several years. So Japan is one of those places people talk about going to, but then in practice, they find it far too hard. So I really think this is an extremely important conversation. So John, really warm welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So give us a bit of your background. So first of all, I think you're an Amazon seller yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So there's two of us in the business, me and my business partner, Neil. He's set up the business initially, and he's been selling for about 4 years on Amazon UK. And then between the two of us, we've been selling for 2 years in Japan.
Excellent. So 2 years of solid experience. That's good to know. So tell us a bit about what was this whole business of Rising Sun Commerce? First of all, what is it and what brought you to starting it?
Sure. So my background is I've done various things in my life, as I guess a lot of business owners, but part of it, I lived in Japan for 5 years between 2005 and 2010. I moved back to the UK in 2010. And I got involved in e-commerce. I've been involved in 2 or 3 different e-commerce projects. And whilst working on those, I was using a co-working space here in Hull, where I'm based in East Yorkshire. And I met a chap called Neil, who is now my business partner. He'd been selling successfully on Amazon through, he's got a private label company, and he was looking at ways to grow his business. And he'd spotted that Amazon were encouraging people to sell in Japan. And he knew that I lived in Japan. So we had a coffee one day and he's like, basically, can you help me sell on in Japan? So I was like, yeah, sure. So that's how it kind of came about, really.
Fantastic. So it's an interesting thing that a lot of the best business ideas come from a conversation with real people, which I'm always encouraging my mentoring clients who are going into a new product area on Amazon to do. Just talk to actual people, never mind the research tools. Second thing is, that you both had something that the other needed. You had the Japanese background and Neil, by the sound of it, had the more of the e-commerce background. So a really fantastic way to start a business, really. So what does Rising Sun Commerce in a nutshell do for people then? What's that about?
So we initially, the first 12 months, we sold our own products on Amazon Japan, but then we realized that there was other people that also wanted to sell through Amazon Japan. So for the past, since about September last year, we've been helping other people sell successfully on Amazon Japan. So that's what we do. We help people sell successfully on Amazon Japan.
Great. Nice and clear. So one question then, why bother selling in Japan? Is it worth, I imagine it's a lot of hassle and we'll explore in detail what is involved, but why bother in the first place?
So looking at the pros, there's 127 million people live in Japan. So it's about double the population of the UK, the third biggest economy in the world. And last year at Amazon Japan overtook the UK to be Amazon's third biggest platform around the world after America and Germany, I think, second. Japan is now third, and the UK slipped to number four. So, yeah, it's a huge opportunity.
Yeah, and that's such a big reality check. I mean, you know, John, you and I met at a Payoneer conference recently where presenting on the subject of Brexit, and not so much like more scaremongering or politics, because nobody needs any more of that. There's enough Facebook, you know, blood spilt to fill oceans. But it was about, you know, here are the possibilities and here are ways to mitigate it. And one thing is simply get out of the UK and start looking at other economies to sell into. And lo and behold, there you came forward as one of the answers.
Yeah.
Amazing that Japan is now bigger than the UK market. It doesn't surprise me, but what amazes me is the mental leap that people don't make. So folks, if you're listening, make the mental leap and consider Japan now bigger than the UK. And that's without Brexit actually kicking in, right? I mean, God knows what will happen after March 2019. I think there's every single argument in considering it.
I mean, another point to make now, I guess, is that the exchange rate is very strong at the moment for the yen to the pound. So, you know, there's another reason in itself. Back when I was living there, it was about 200 yen to the pound. It's about 135 now. So,
wow. So it's really dropped. So again, the devaluation of the pound can be great or terrible, depending on which way you flip it. But if you're based in the UK and selling into an economy with a currency that's strong against the pound, you're laughing. So I guess, again, you're implying that with the Japanese yen, it's very much the case, right?
Yeah, at the moment, obviously these things change, but
of course, yeah. But I can't see structurally why it would massively shift. I mean, it, you know, these things do shift. But okay, so some very good reasons to go into it. So, does it work the same as it is in the UK and USA? Then how does it compare? Is it the same basic process, or are there some big differences?
Yeah, basically, it's exactly the same. The only real difference is the language that you know, the outward facing listings. The back end of Amazon, you can access in English. So it's relatively straightforward to see where everything is. The layout of the Amazon Seller Central is also pretty much the same as it is in the UK. The fulfillment centers are they work exactly the same way as they do in the UK. So from an Amazon point of view, it's pretty much exactly the same. It's just the customer interface is all in Japanese.
Right. And presumably, one question, is the Seller Central account in Japanese? Can you flip that over to be in English as well?
Yeah, you can access it in English. So that you as a seller is all in English, yeah.
Well, that's really worth knowing. So in other words, once you've got your head around Seller Central in the UK or USA, which is, let's face it, is a dog's dinner anyway. It's a real mess. And that's historic to how Amazon organizes things and has grown. But yeah, if you can handle that, you can handle the Seller Central in Japan. So, okay, so the barriers to entry are slipping down.
Yeah.
So how hard is it? It's a kind of dumb question because you can't really answer this specifically, but I'm going to ask the dumb question anyway. How hard is it?
If you can sell on Amazon UK, you can sell in Japan. Or if you can sell in Europe, you can sell in Japan. Because I don't know about you, what your language skills are like, but I'm not very good at German or French or Spanish. So it's basically the equivalent of translating your listing into a different language. You know, if I see German listing, I wouldn't have a clue what was going on. And likewise, you know.
Yeah.
It just looks intimidating, I think, for us, because it's, you know, the alphabets are, you know, not the Roman alphabets. Everything looks really intimidating, but in actual fact, it's just a different language. So,
yeah, I like your thinking. I mean, funnily enough that you mentioned that, I do speak German fluently and my French is pretty decent. So I don't speak Spanish or Italian much. I mean, I can kind of bullshit when I go there from my music background. I've learned a lot of Italian, but I can say crazy things like a little bit faster, but not too much, and make sure you're with the violins. Or, yeah. But, joking aside, I mean, yeah, I do have that advantage. But I think you've put your finger on
one very important thing that I want to drill home, because I deal with people trying to persuade them to go into Germany, which is like, you know, a few hundred miles away, for goodness sake, from where we are in the UK for most of us. I mean, depending if you're in Scotland, maybe a whole 1,000 miles, but it's not USA and it's not Japan, but it is a mental barrier, right? And
actually, yeah,
that's it. It is a language problem. You just need to find somebody who can solve a language problem, I think. Yeah. So very reassuring. So it's already sounding less hard than it used to be. So what are the upsides to selling in Japan then that you don't get in the UK or Europe or the USA? It sounds like a lot of things work the same. It's obviously a huge population. It's the third biggest marketplace we've heard already, which is amazing. What are the other upsides?
I think there's less competition, certainly compared to the UK. You know, selling on Amazon and e-commerce generally has really taken off in the UK. I mean, the UK's, I think, one of the, it's at the forefront of e-commerce and kind of has been for a long time. Whereas, bizarrely, Japan, you know, despite people's imagination that Japan is a technological superpower in e-commerce, it's kind of been slower to catch on. So, you know, that's another good opportunity for us Brits to kind of apply our skills in e-commerce and, you know, do well over there, really.
That's makes a lot of sense. And it's when you say it's less competitive, I mean, it's a very valid point. It's kind of unsurprising, as you say. I think the UK has the biggest penetration of e-commerce as a percentage of retail, which may explain all those, you know, high street stores that we see in the newspapers every day, you know, that Cavendish House, John Lewis, whatever, is struggling. And so that means that a lot of the growth has already happened. It's still happening very much, but it's harder. And yeah, you're right. There's a lot of competition, I think, partly because there are lazy Americans, and no offense to them, the Brits know better, who are worried about language barriers. So they just send their stuff over and do a listing in English in the UK, and they don't bother with Germany, and they certainly don't bother with Japan. So
yeah,
that makes a lot of sense, you know.
I think another thing, Rakuten, you may have heard of, is the other big e-commerce player in Japan, but that's sort of been slipping backwards as Amazon has been taking over the market share. So Amazon is really increasing its market share in Japan. So, you know, as a seller, if you can ride that wave of growth that Amazon is doing, then if once you're at, you know, top of the best sellers list, it's harder to be knocked off than it is when it's a super competitive place to get there in the first place. So
absolutely. You know, listen, the rising tide raises all ships, as they say in investment, right? So if Amazon's pushing for it, which it sounds they obviously are, then, you know, we're on the tidal wave of one of the world's biggest companies. That makes absolute sense. So lots of really good news. What are the difficulties, the particular challenges that we need to overcome in order to access this promised land?
So obviously the elephant in the room is the language and all that goes with that, because, you know, there's three different alphabets and it's not the same as ours. So, you know, when you're looking at products and doing research and stuff, it can be quite intimidating to do that. Other things, if you're selling from the UK, perhaps, then there's the shipping that's a problem. You know, if your goods are manufactured locally, then, you know, you have to ship them there. Obviously, if your goods are manufactured in China or the Far East, then it's actually a positive to sell in Japan, because the shipping time to Japan is so much nearer. There's the taxes to overcome. But that's the same as, you know, any other country, and they're relatively straightforward to do. You pay those at the point of import when your goods arrive. And you also need something called an importer of record, which is somebody in Japan to be responsible for your goods coming into Japan.
Okay, so yeah. They're not insolvable problems. It sounds to me extremely similar, apart from the language thing, which is like Germany. So I guess for me, I've seen people make pretty easy successes there. The language, I think, is a very technical and therefore very solvable problem. You find a Japanese speaker who understands Amazon. They don't grow on trees, but you and your company are the people to talk to.
Yeah.
So you'll be hearing from me personally. I can promise you this is like a fantastic opportunity. I mean, joking apart, that I'm getting into this for sure, because I did actually mean what I said in the Brexit talk. I want to mitigate risk, and Japan looks like an amazing opportunity. Importer of record and taxes on importing, that's no different to the USA.
Uh-huh.
That's very solvable. Most people are very comfortable with doing that. And then the research. So tell me a bit about the research. That almost sounds to be a bit more of a barrier. I mean, most of the brands that you work with, I know, are already selling. But if you need to do research from scratch in Japan, how would you go about that as somebody?
Yes, so there's no real tools, you know, like Jungle Scout's obviously the big one, the market leader for doing research.
And yeah,
that doesn't really work in Japan. So you're left with doing manual research and going through the bestseller lists kind of thing and trying to gain a bit of understanding. And a lot of the tools of, you know, keywords and things like that, they don't really work in Japan. We're struggling to find ones that are actually giving good results.
Right.
So you just have to do it manually, go on instinct, or if you've got a product that sells well in another marketplace, the chances are it'll do well in Japan as well. So I'd go with what you know already and try what, you know, try a product that is already successful.
So you're suggesting this isn't a place for brand new sellers to go then, particularly by the sound of it, because you need to probably have some metrics from UK or USA or wherever else, Germany maybe, to bring across to Japan as your best guess of what's going to sell. Is that about right?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're a brand new seller, you're much better learning the ropes of Amazon in your own language, because you'll be a lot more comfortable with that, and it's easier to understand in your own language than it is, you know. There's an extra barrier to learn when you're selling overseas, so start with your own language first.
Yeah, I guess you're right. As long as I think you're right, I'm sure. And I would also say that as long as you treat, for example, if you want to start in the UK, as long as you know that you're selling to a competitive marketplace where the currency that people are buying is challenged, and therefore the people who, you know, everything we eat or drive is mostly imported. So the consumers have had their spending squeezed effectively by the drop in the value of the pound. And as long as you know all that and it's training wheels, I suspect you're going to be better off moving to Japan or Germany pretty soon, because you can't argue with the currency exchange rates. So yeah, interesting. Okay, so it's not for newbies, but I would encourage you to get in there pretty quick, guys, because this sounds really, really good. So can you give us an example of the kind of product then? Let's talk through an example. This all sounds very good in the abstract. Very, very promising, in fact. So tell us a bit about an example product that you've taken through, and we can look at the nuts and bolts that arise from that.
Yeah, sure. I think the best example to give is we sell a car seat mirror, which allows parents to see their newborn baby, you know, when they're in a rear facing car seat in the back of the car. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, there's a case study on our website which has kind of got all the details about it. So that was the first product that we sent over, and that was, you know, that was a success for us, which encouraged us to continue.
How did you decide on that, first of all, and what was the choice?
Again, back to my previous point, it's what we were selling in the UK, and we were happy with the results there. So, you know, we knew we'd had a good relationship with our supplier in China, so we just got an extra batch made for Japan.
Nice. Okay, so you were selling that in the UK originally, were you? Or was it USA or elsewhere?
No, just in the UK to begin with, and then Japan was our second place.
Okay, so you simply, Cecily, used the... And can I ask then what the comparison is between your sales and your profit in the UK versus in Japan with the same products so far anyway?
Sales... per day, probably slightly less in Japan. They're sort of 60-70%. Now, it does obviously fluctuate quite a lot, but, you know, yes, ballpark figure. And the profit margins have been a little bit higher, maybe 10-15% higher. So
that's actually quite significant. Yeah. And so you basically, if you've got 60-70% of the revenue and you've got 15% increase in profits, the profit from each marketplace is probably quite similar then, I guess, UK and Japan. Is that about
right? Yeah, can be. I mean, obviously, depends on individual products and competition.
So of course. No, I'm just thinking about your...
Yeah, for us, it worked out to be similar, yeah.
Yeah, and we're not making any guarantees that everybody is going to make 70% of the revenue they're making in the UK and Japan. But yeah, it's good to start from some data, albeit just one bit of data, if you like, one case study. Okay, so how did you decide on the ordering quantities then? Because obviously you don't have Jungle Scout or Market Intelligence or whatever the other tools are that people like to use, Helium 10, I guess. How did you decide on the ordering quantities?
We just plucked to figure out the eggs, to be honest.
That's fair enough. Be honest. Sometimes it's good enough, you know. Why not?
When Neil sent his first batch, when he first got his first batch manufactured in the UK here, he just got a batch of 500 done. But we thought, by the time we've paid for shipping and things, we kind of instinctively we felt confident that we could sell 3 a day. So that's 1,000 mirrors within a year. You know, because we'd looked at the general sales data of Amazon Japan, so we knew it was, you know, fairly decent. So you know, we thought, yeah, worst case scenario, we should be able to sell 1,000 within a year. So then we sort of saw that as being worst case scenario. So that's basically why we went for that. I think looking back with my, you know, it would have been probably wiser to maybe just got 500 done to begin with. But yeah, it was fine
doing it. Yeah. Okay, interesting. So a couple of things to reflect on that. I mean, the first thing, just guide me on this a bit. If we are having to sort of guesstimate sales, I guess if we assume that Japan's about the size of UK or between UK and Germany, and you could use Jungle Scout, I guess, to look on for the sort of equivalent of BSR number one in baby in Germany is, you know, X $1,000 a month or whatever a year. And then the same in the UK, and you can kind of guesstimate that Japan's likely to be in a range between those two. I mean, of course, that's quite approximate. Is that an approximation that would make sense, or have you got some other guidance on that?
I think I might steal your idea and write a blog.
Yeah, do you? Buy me a beer next time we're at the conference. Yeah, I think I'm always comfortable with starting with some kind of data, but recognizing that we're wrong. But yeah, we might as well get the right best estimate we can, whilst acknowledging the humility that we don't know. And actually, what I think I like about this very much is, number one, everybody's not using the same damn tools to get the same results and saying the same things. So that's an opportunity for those of us who are willing to get our hands dirty and do a bit of research of our own. And the second thing is that, again, the truth is, just because you've used a load of tools doesn't mean that you've done a pretty spreadsheet and you've talked it through some people in a mastermind, if you're smart enough to be in a mastermind, and all the best sellers I know are. I mean, I guess there must be some exceptions, but pretty much all the people that I meet are. So even assuming you've done all that, what you get is a false sense of security. Like, you've done a billion emails back and forth to your supplier, you've looked at a million tools, you've talked to a lot of clever people, you've done a spreadsheet. I believe that gives you a false sense of security, because you don't actually know exactly how much it's going to sell. And in my experience, it's either a lot less than you expect or more.
So
what I like about this Japanese experience is it forces you to acknowledge from the beginning that you don't know. And that means you take a risk proportionately, you know. So I could go on to that. There's some game theory behind it, whatever, but that's quite a profound thing. Like, false certainty is worse than knowing what you don't know. So I think I'm liking this more and more, I have to say.
I think if you've got a product that you know you're happy with and, you know, is a good quality product yourself, then why would you go looking for a new product for a new market just for the sake of it? You know, if you've got confidence in your product as being a great product, then, you know, I'm sure it'd do well in Japan too, you know, providing there's a need and use for it in Japan, which for 90% of things there are.
Oh, that was another question that I was going to ask about. Are the same sort of products going to sell in Japan as sell in the UK? We've already implied that to a degree, or USA, I guess. So it implies already that you think that's true. Are there products where you should say this is not a Japan suitable product?
Yeah, so thinking back, there was one case, a company was selling like add-ons for radiators like we have in the UK. It was like a towel dryer for a radiator. But in Japan, they don't have radiators like we have here. They use a different sort of heating system, these kerosene heaters. So this add-on for the radiator just would not sell in Japan, kind of thing. And when he came to me, I sort of said straight away, you know, no, it's Japan's no good for you. Another consideration is like Japan's not a Christian country, so that they don't really celebrate Christmas. So Christmas presents and, you know, Christmas trees, anything like that, not going to do very well in Japan with. So there are some products where it won't do well, but they're kind of few and far between, really. You know, most products will be absolutely fine. Japanese also, human too.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, I think what you're implying is the sort of thing that people really, really should be doing. Again, it forces you to do the stuff you should be doing anyway. If you're not taking any interest in the culture you're selling into, then you're going to be in trouble, because you're not doing the 101 of marketing, which is understand your target market. And if they're Japanese, you should kind of just find out, like, you know, a little bit about Japanese households. If you're selling in the house and home kind of categories, you know, what does a Japanese house look like? You know, you can Google. I mean, this doesn't take any more effort than that. When are the main holidays in Japan? Again, a quick Google will tell you that. If you're British and you've been living on the moon and you don't know the Americans celebrate the 4th of July, that's not a thing here.
Yeah.
But I was in France a while ago with my then girlfriend, our wife, and we were on holiday, and it was the 14th of July, and we're just driving the motorways. It was empty. I thought, why is it so empty? And I thought, 14th of July, Bastille Day. But of course, you don't know your French culture, you don't know that, but it doesn't take much to just do a bit of research, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And again, I think what I like about this, again, it's forcing good business disciplines upon us, which we should be doing anyway. We can't get lazy when something is obviously a little bit more foreign than we used to. So, okay, so basically, we just got to, if we're selling in a category, we just need to get a sense of what people do in that category. Like if they're heating their houses, what do they do for heating? We need to check that Christmas is not a thing. I understand from you that there are other holidays that they celebrate big time there. What are the big sort of opportunities there if it's not Christmas?
Yeah, so there's Obon, which is the summer holiday. There's Golden Week, which is in May time. And then New Year's the sort of main winter holiday, which is kind of the equivalent of our Christmas. Families get together and eat lots of nice food and sit in front of the TV all day.
Okay. So in other words, there is a sort of Q4 uplift, but it doesn't happen until technically Q1. But yeah, so New Year, a couple of weeks really after Christmas.
Not really, because it's not really a present-giving culture.
I see. You're right.
You wouldn't see the same sort of Q4 uplift as you do.
Okay. So that's not really an opportunity for us so much as sellers. But is this Golden Week a big thing to make money from? Or
Again, not really. I mean, there's no real present giving culture at any particular time kind of thing. They do have Mother's Day and Father's Day and but Valentine's Day. Halloween's becoming a big event in Japan over recent years, and fancy dress costumes and things like that. So that's possibly worth considering if you...
Yeah, I've heard about that. So yeah, it does seem interesting. So again, this is very valuable stuff. So actually, it sounds to me like, apart from maybe Valentine's Day, which my instinct says that the Japanese are going mad for, I don't quite know why, it seems to have that kitsch element they love, but I don't know if that's true.
They also have a thing called White Day as well. So in Japan, Valentine's Day is slightly different in that... I can't remember which way around it. The ladies buy the men something, and then on the 14th of March, a month after Valentine's Day, the men are expected to reciprocate and buy the ladies something.
Ooh, interesting. So again, it's worth just learning a bit about the culture. I mean, you obviously, having lived there, you have a very good understanding of this. Is this something you advise on? Are you a sort of Japanese cultural e-commerce advisor, or is that not part of the package?
We don't really. I mean, if you've got an idea for a product that you want to sell, and I'll tell you if I don't think it's a goer.
Right, okay, well, that's just as valuable.
Radiator, but I don't know. I'll tell you if I don't think it's a goer, but if I think it's worthwhile trying, then I'd
just go ahead. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, but that's very, very valuable. I mean, a lot of the time somebody is, you know, saying don't sell this can save you a lot of heartache. So that's really
good.
Tell me another couple of things then. Well, first of all, about that, before we just skip over the holidays thing, obviously in the UK and USA, Christmas is huge, and it's sort of 50% of retail sales happening in Q4. It sounds to me like in Japan, things are much more evenly spread and they're not really particularly focused on particular dates. Is that accurate, or does it work a different way?
Yeah, no, I'd say there's more of an even spread throughout the year. Yeah,
that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's really valuable, because I mean, I think all of us get a bit sort of seasick with the, you know, January dead sales, and then on the other hand, scrambling to get enough inventory together for Christmas. It's a bit of a roller coaster ride, particularly in the US, where the numbers can be so monstrous that you buy a ton of inventory for Christmas, and either you run out of stock on the 1st of December, or you have a total overhang of stock on Japan January the 1st. So that's actually really very interesting, actually.
Perhaps the toys and games could be an interesting category. I mean, although they're not a Christian country and they don't celebrate Christmas, commercialism does come into play still, and children still kind of get a few Christmas presents. It's not the same scale as it is here kind of thing, but you know, they would still get something from their parents at least at Christmas time, I think.
Okay, so they do Christmas for kids more than anything else then?
Yeah, and then I guess... New Year, going back to New Year, children tend to be given money on New Year's Day, called a Toshidama, which can add up to, you know, significant amounts, hundreds of pounds kind of thing for teenagers. So they might have holes, fire burning in their pockets by the time they've got that on, you know, coming into January style. time kind of thing. So they might.
Interesting. So kind of kids products around the Christmas time and then for teens around New Year.
Perhaps. Yeah. But I don't know what types of products Japanese teenagers would buy.
Who knows, that's probably a speculative thing, I guess.
I don't know if Fortnite exists in Japan, that game that seems to be all the rage at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, to keep it simple, the two things I'm taking from this are, number one, you can basically sell most stuff that we're selling in the West, unless, you know, you run it past John and he'll just go, no, they don't use that. I mean, you are going to be the simplifying factor, I think. A bit of Googling is a wise idea as well, I feel. And the other thing is, broadly speaking, it's a flatter kind of revenue, so it doesn't go, you know, crazy at Christmas or so dead either, I guess, in January. So that's actually quite a good balance for other e-commerce marketplaces, talking of creating a business as a whole.
Yeah.
So tell me about packaging, first of all, do we need Japanese-specific packagings that have to be in Japanese? Because obviously, if, for example, in your case, you got, say, 500 units being made in China of a product and you just want to try 100 units out in Japan, you don't really want to go to the expense of getting a translation made, new packaging with all the minimum order quantities that entails and stuff. How would you deal with that?
So I think officially it probably does need to be in Japanese, but in reality, Amazon don't really check, I don't think, or don't really care. All your sales is done on Amazon, so you don't need it, I don't think, from a customer point of view, because the buying decision is made in advance anyway. The best way around it, if you don't want to go to the extent of getting your packaging fully redesigned and translated, would be to put inserts into your packaging in Japanese. So you're still giving that nice customer experience, but it's a lot cheaper than getting your packaging redesigned. That would be sort of the first step I'd go to.
Presumably, if you've got your phone number, or I don't know what you do, but a phone number or a support email, if you want to try and get people to contact you outside of Amazon so you don't get rude reviews and what have you, if there's a problem, presumably you could get a little sticker and just slap that on each of the...
You can ask your supplier
to do that, right?
Exactly, yeah. Putting stickers on the box would be a way around it too. Exactly, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and also I suppose, really, people buy stuff off the listing, right? As long as the listing's accurate and what you receive, aside from the language, is the same, then I guess you haven't got a problem, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think if the product arrives and it's got, like, you know, English instructions and no Japanese support inside it, then I think they feel a bit disappointed, and they're probably more likely to leave a negative review if they don't feel it has that. So it's kind of worth putting some, I guess, support and instructions in Japanese, or even just a welcome note in Japanese kind of thing. It puts the customer at ease.
Seems reasonable. And I think that would be pretty easy to do, and very, very inexpensive as well. I mean, you're probably talking about a unit for an insert card and maybe 20 cents a unit to stick a label on or something. So, I mean, it's going to be pretty cheap and easy, right?
Exactly. I mean, when we sent our mirrors originally, we did get the packaging translated into Japanese. We were doing 1,000, so we thought that was worth it. We might as well go ahead with that. I'm glad we did. But it shouldn't be a barrier to not having Japanese packaging. Since then, we've actually turned our packaging into multi-language, so we just use one package for each different marketplace.
Yeah, that's smart. I mean, multi-language packaging. That's the way to go, right? That's what the big companies do. You get the economies of scale, don't you? One packaging run for all the different markets. And I guess, to be honest, in terms of the big markets, you need English for America and UK, you need German for Germany, and you need Japanese for Japan. I would be tempted to limit it to that. Everyone was always trying to sell into every single European marketplace. My experience is, if you get the right product, like watches seem to do well in Italy. I know a couple of people who've done really well there, but majority of people, it's all about Germany. So you could probably simplify that whole thing down to a sort of global packaging strategy that's actually pretty easy. Excellent. Well, we solved that one then. There aren't that many massive issues, really. I mean, okay, so what are the other expenses or issues? You talked about importing. So you've got import duties and tax and the importer of record thing. Now, let's talk that through. That sounds a bit more daunting initially. How does that work?
The import duties and tax, depending on your product category and your HIS code, I think import duties sort of between 3 and 6, 7, 8%. And then you've got kind of like a sales tax at the point of import, which is 8% as well.
Okay, and what is that? 8% of what?
Sorry? Oh, it's 8% of your bill of lading and shipping fees all added together.
Okay, so similar to VAT then. So you add up your product cost, the freight cost, any insurance, I guess, and then you take 20% of that for VAT. So is it the same kind of thing?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, and only 8%. So immediately, folks, so just think this through. If you're shipping from China to Japan, how long is the shipping to Japan? It must be way quicker than by sea.
2 weeks, basically, door to door.
Wow, okay, amazing. Door to what? So you mean from your supplier's factory to...
From your supplier's factory to Amazon FBA center.
Amazing. So 2 weeks as opposed to 2 months. So presumably it's a lot cheaper. And then as soon as it lands in the UK, you've got to pay VAT of 20% on top of that more expensive freight. So 8% of much less freight plus the product cost, or 20% of much more expensive freight plus product cost. You do the math, as they say in America. I mean, this is starting to sound more and more attractive, I have to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got the import duty and the tax, so it adds up to around 10 to 12%.
But that's the same in the UK. I mean, I've been very careless and missed that out. You're quite right. Actually, in the UK, you'd add up the product cost, the freight cost, and the import duty, and then put 20% VAT on top of that. So yeah, you're quite right. I'd forgotten that. So I still think it compares pretty well. It compares. I can't imagine it'd be anything except better. I really can't. So that's really powerful.
It's a level playing field anyway, because anybody that's, you know, importing stuff into Japan, everybody has to pay the same. So as long as you include it in your pricing, it's a level playing field.
That's a good point as well. And again, the level playing field is not something that we have in the UK. I think there's a lot of American and especially Chinese sellers that are not VAT registered that should be, meaning that, you know, there's all sorts of downsides for people who live in the UK and probably have to VAT register because you've got to be careful when you actually live somewhere and you get arrested. So what other costs come with importing? Do you have anything else that comes on top?
There's the importer of record stuff. Now, as you mentioned originally, my wife is Japanese, and when we sent our first batch, we got one of her family members to be our importer of record and act as being responsible for the goods that we were sending. Since then, we've teamed up with a shipping company which also offer that service, and they take care of it for us and for our clients these days.
Okay, so you got a shipping company that just deals with that. I have to say, this sounds great. I have to say, I'm so excited about this because Trump's slapping import duties on Chinese goods going to America, and plus it's hyper-competitive. UK is going through Brexit soon. Japan's sounding very good, I have to say. So tell me a bit more, what are the fees? So it's just the importer record, or are there any other costs of importing that we've got to deal with?
No, that's basically, well, there's inspection fees if your goods get inspected by customs at the port.
All right. And how does that work? Is that a common occurrence? Is it just a sort of occasional, or?
It depends on a lot of different factors, really. How much you ship in, what your reputation is with the customs. If you're doing less than a container load, what else is in the container? And so it's hard to give an overview, really. But if it does happen, you've just got to
suck it up, as I say. But I have to say also, just to be fair to Japan or Amazon Japan, exactly the same happens coming to the UK. We had that a while ago with pretty small, I was only a few hundred units coming into the UK because it's not such a big market for us. And we had an inspection that delayed things for a week. It didn't actually cost us anything amazingly. Again, I've had a member of the 10K Collective, Ashley Pierce, who's been on the show and doing very, very well. But he had an entire container stocked at US Customs and they inspected it and he had to pay for the privilege. So that happens elsewhere as well. I think it's probably more expensive and worse in the US than in the UK. I don't remember paying for it. Maybe we owe them a bill. But again, to be fair, it doesn't sound very different. And we'd have to look at statistics to know, but...
Yeah, the delay you mentioned of a week there, I've not heard of anything being a week delayed through inspection. They're normally quite efficient and get it done within 24, 48 hours if it is inspected at all.
So. Oh, wow, that is good. Yeah, I think in the US, you're looking at a lot more than that. And in the UK, it can be a few days. I mean, again, not being alarmist, but if Brexit happens, delays of a week are going to sound like the most hyper-efficiency your grandmother will remember, because in 2 years' time, we might be buried in imports that take 10 weeks to process, because they will have the biggest backlog literally in the world. So again, without being alarmist, I mean, why not skip all that crap? I mean, this is sounding ever better. Okay, so tell us about FBA. You've mentioned, you know, shipping into an FBA warehouse. So that is presumably available, unlike, for example, I think Amazon Australia just introduced it, actually, but some marketplaces don't really support it so well. Is that a fully functioning?
Fully functioning. They've got about 7 or 8 different warehouses dotted throughout the country. You know, you register for your inbound shipment where you do on Amazon UK. You know, it works exactly the same system. As they create the barcodes, it tells you which warehouse, it directs you to which warehouse to ship your stock to. So, yeah, happens exactly the same.
Amazing. Way. So once you've got your head around Seller Central and inbound shipping, which takes a while in the UK, it's no different in Japan, really.
No, it's the same. Right. The one thing to say is that the costs of the storage fees, the FBA storage costs, are considerably more expensive in Japan than they are in the US and the UK, really. So I kind of, as we were chatting last week about what to talk about in this podcast, I have gone and created a little spreadsheet of comparing the different costs of the different.
Oh, marvelous. You're a fantastic man. And so that brings me to the point, folks, of just mentioning that if you want to check out all this fantastic information from John, just go to amazingfba.com/John, J-O-H-N-C. I should double check. That is the spelling, right? J-O-H-N.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So it's J-O-H-N-C for Kant. And that's how we do all our podcasts. And we'll put a page there with links, including, if you'll share it, the spreadsheet, because that sounds really helpful indeed.
Yeah, I'll put that up there. Yeah, you can use that.
Again, playing devil's advocate, although the US doesn't have such astronomically expensive fees yet, they are going only one way, which is up, because they have a capacity problem in the US. And there's a bit of a strategic issue, which goes to the core of Amazon's kind of profit strategy, really, which is, or their whole strategy, which is to avoid sales tax. And that means they've been avoiding building FCs, fulfillment centers in multiple states, because they didn't want to incur a sales tax liability there. So that's an ongoing thing that's been dragging on really since the dawn of Amazon's existence.
Right.
And I think gradually the tide is turning in favor of the authorities. So watch this space, but I don't see the fees going any way but up, especially at Q4. And they have recently published some increased fees. So it's all relative.
Yeah. Well, when I say that fees in Japan are a lot more expensive than other places, there's a different... Yeah, depends whether you're looking at Q4 or not.
So, right.
The calculation I've done is it works out 53 English pence, British pence, per cubic foot in Q1, Q2, Q3, but rises to £1.85 per cubic foot in Q4 in America.
Right.
Whereas in Japan, it's slightly more evenly split, up being £1.51. Versus £1.75.
Okay, so it's substantially higher, but it's more consistent, which is interesting. So,
yeah.
Again, you haven't got the variability, which is reassuring. So, presumably, that's just simply because the Japanese population is squeezed into a tiny area around, or the uninhabitable, the mountain bit in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's got high population density as it is. It's only 1.5 times the size of the UK, but it's got double the population. There's a load of mountains in the middle, so everybody lives in the big cities and the plains dotted around them. So,
okay. So I guess what that implies, though, is you just need to be, I mean, once you've done your initial, you know, stick the tail on the donkey kind of stock guess, as you did, and maybe everyone has to do the first time out, once you've got some good numbers, you just need to make sure that you sell through your inventory and have that discipline to order about the right amount of inventory and not hang on to too much.
Yeah, I think the lesson is to maybe go slightly more conservative. You know, if you've got a choice of going conservative or aggressive, err on the side of caution and go slightly more conservative. And that way you're not going to be facing the big 6 month, 12 month plus storage fees that hit you. And if you sell out, then that's great. You know that there's demand for your products, and you've learned that, and you can reorder stock and make sure that you know, you get the profit within the next batch kind of thing if you lose the momentum of the first one.
So. Yeah, sounds good. I mean, yeah, exactly. You've got to be willing to treat the first anything, whether it's the first order to Japan or the first launch of a new product in US or UK, as an experiment, right? And I absolutely couldn't agree more. And I think that's a good place to wrap up this first episode. So John, very excited. I was very, very pleased when you approached me because I thought this is perfectly ties in with the whole sort of global approach that I'm trying to take these days and encourage other people to see problems coming and also find places where there'll be opportunities. And to me, Japan just looks like mostly upside with no downside relative to the changes in the UK or USA. So very exciting stuff. Stay tuned, folks. Look out for the next episode from John. And meanwhile, thank you very much, John, and see you in the next episode to talk about how to launch in Japan.
Absolute pleasure. See you soon.
See you in a bit.
That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Now, over to you. First, 80-20 everything. Learn the critical few. Maybe there's one thing in this podcast that can make all the difference. Find that thing. 20% of inputs, give 80% of the outputs. Which are the critical few for you? Then take action. Imperfect action beats perfect inaction every single time. Finally, and not least, review. If you've made mistakes, learn from them. If you've made a success, duplicate it. You can't do that unless you look back. So in summary, learn the critical few, then do, then review. And then, my friend, it's up to you. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Speak to you in the next episode.